Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for Thursday, April 11th, 2024. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Patty Daniels and myself, Scott Splavik. And now here's Patty with our first story.
Thank you, Scott. Biggest homecoming. Excuse me, there's a photograph at the top with a gentleman behind a podium, and he's giving a speech, and it says on the caption, Race Director Emeritus and 50th Planning Committee member Ed Frelick speaks during a Quad City Times BIX press conference on Wednesday. Frelick announced a new race will be among the events this year, the Bechdel Trust Senior BIX for those 50 and up. BIX 7 announces new race, other changes for 50th year. Written for us by Gannon Hannibald. The Quad City Times BIX 7 has changed a lot in its 50 years. It has expanded, added new elements, and adapted. In 2020, when the pandemic kept runners from congregating, the race even added a virtual element that's still in use today. This year, for the 50th running, the famous Downtown Davenport Road Race will see a few more changes, Quad City Times BIX 7 race leaders announced on Wednesday. The first major change is that there will be a new event on this year's schedule, the Bechdel Trust Senior BIX. The race, which will start in LeClaire Park, will be specifically made for runners age 50 and up. The course will be a mile and a half and on an entirely flat track, allowing runners who don't want to conquer the Brady Street Hill to still participate in the action. Race Director Emeritus Ed Frelick said it will be a great way to involve some of the runners that have been around for the 50 years of BIX 7 history. There's so many people that want to be a part of it, but they don't want to go up Brady Street Hill, he said. This will give them the opportunity to be part of something that they've been doing for years. People have done it 25, 30 times. Now they're in their 70s and they can be part of the 50th anniversary. The Senior BIX race will be held on Tuesday, July 23rd, days before the main events on Saturday, July 27th. It marks the continued expansion of Quad City Times BIX 7 events beyond official race day. It's really going to be special, Frelick said. It used to be BIX weekend, and now from Sunday the week before to the Sunday of the next week, it's all going to be BIX. The week will also open with a special statue unveiling Frelick and race director Michelle Juring shared on Wednesday. On Monday, July 22nd, there will be the presentation of a statue of Carl Ungurian, the second Quad City Times BIX 7 race director who died in late 2022. At the first race when the people ran, he and his wife went over to the old bank in the corner and sat down to manually tally the results, Juring said. He's been a part of the race every year until he passed after the 48th. This year will also mark a first for the Quad City Times BIX 7, as they'll have four iconic racers all participating in the same race. Frank Shorter, marathon and gold medalist, the 1972 Olympics, Joan Benoit Samuelson, marathon gold medalist at the 1984 Olympics, Bill Rogers, also known as BIX Billy, who has run the Quad City Times BIX 7 every year since 1980, and Meb Keflezighi, silver medalist in the marathon at the 2004 Olympics. Frelick said he believes it's the first time all four runners have raced with each other. Rogers and Shorter will both participate in the Bechdel Trust Senior BIX 2. People can not only run it on a short, flat race course, but they can also run it with Bill and Frank, Frelick said. It's going to be a big deal. And
I think that that will be all for that one. And OLGCA to close at end of year. Written for us by Olivia Allen of the QC Times. Our Lady of Grace Catholic Academy. Now, they use the initials OLGCA in East Moline will close at the end of the school year due to low enrollment, maintenance costs, and other factors. The Diocese of Peoria said in a press release Wednesday it plans to help OLGCA families transition to Catholic elementary schools in Moline and Rock Island and place teachers and or staff in open positions throughout the area. According to the diocese, OLGCA has seen a 35% drop in enrollment over the past 4 years, and the school was originally scheduled to close after the 2021-22 school year. While that decision was ultimately reversed, the diocese put forth a timeline for OLGCA to reach key enrollment and financial benchmarks to gauge the futures of the school's sustainability. Among these targets was reaching an enrollment of 135 students for the by the 2024-25 school year. This year's enrollment is 102 students, and a recent survey conducted by OLGCA school leaders projects at least a 10-student loss next school year, the release said. Enrollment has fallen by 35% over the past 4 years. The decision to close OLGCA is a painful one for the students, families, and staff. When the benchmarks were established for OLGCA back in 2022, we were optimistic that the school would be able to reach them, Jerry Sanderson, interim superintendent of schools for the diocese, said in the press release. Unfortunately, despite the heroic efforts of school families and parishioners to save the school, factors beyond anyone's control have led to the difficult determination that the school is no longer viable. In addition to enrollment declines, the release also cited the cost of maintaining the school's four aging buildings, frequent administrative turnover, ongoing teacher shortages, and the difficulty in hiring and retaining teachers for less pay than the area's public schools. The end of Illinois Invest in Kids Scholarship Tax Credit Program, which the state did not renew last year. The release did not further explain how these factors contributed to the closure. Messages in school to school officials were not immediately returned Wednesday evening. While I am committed to the mission of Catholic education, and I greatly value our schools, we cannot ignore the reality. I am saddened that OLGCA must now close, Bishop Louis Tilka said in the diocese's announcement. However, at times, we must recognize that the circumstances have changed dramatically since the time when a school first opened. While it is hard to separate our emotions and attachment to a particular institution, we have to be able to consider with a realistic and honest assessment what is viable and sustainable in the future. In a separate message to OLGCA, posted on the school's website, Sanderson said he recognizes some people will be angry, bitter, or sad in response to the decision. While we have every right to experience these emotions, I hope that in the weeks to come we can direct our thoughts and prayers upon the great gift that OLGCA and its predecessors, St. Anne and St. Mary's School, have been to the community, he said. While the school may be closing, I am grateful that the outstanding Catholic education it has provided will live on in the hearts and minds of its graduates for decades to come. OLGCA formed in 2005 from the merger of two prior Catholic schools in East Moline, St. Anne's School, founded in 1925, and St. Mary's School, founded in 1912.
Next is an article entitled Duck Creek Sewer Line Construction Underway. It's written by Sarah Watson of the Quad City Times. The city of Davenport's major project to replace miles worth of sewer and decommission an old lagoon system is underway in northwest Davenport. Duck Creek Trail goers may have noticed trail closures and scores of trees felled near the creek between Northwest Park and Hickory Grove Road. That tree clearing will make way for the first of roughly 5 miles of new sanitary sewer pipes from I-280 to Northwest Park near Hickory Grove Road, which will allow the city to disconnect the West Locust Lagoons near the industrial businesses off I-280 and pipe it into the city's sewer system. The bulk of the city's $16.25 million project is funded from the $40 million in federal COVID-19 relief dollars allocated to Davenport as part of the American Rescue Plan Act passed by Congress in 2021. The council budgeted $14 million for it, and the remaining cost is expected to be funded by unspent sewer funds. In December, the city council approved a contract with Valley Construction Company of Rock Island to do the work. The work going on right now, said Clay Merritt, the city's director of engineering and capital projects, is making the site ready for construction. The new sewer pipe will be laid between 20 and 30 feet deep in places, which requires clearing the land for safety purposes. The lagoon system the city is decommissioning was likely built for the cluster of private industrial development off the northwest corner of I-280 and Locust Street, Merritt said. At some point, most likely in the 70s or 80s, the city accepted responsibility for operating the lagoon, Merritt said. Typically, when residents flush a toilet or turn on the sink, the contents drain through their sewer lateral to the public underground sewer system, which operates similarly to the city's road network. Following gravity, it makes its way to the city's riverfront interceptor sewer, which follows the contours of the river to the water pollution control plant. The plant treats the wastewater of Davenport, Bettendorf, Panorama Park, and Riverdale, and discharges the treated wastewater, once it meets DNR standards, into the Mississippi River. Lagoon systems like the one at I-280 and Locust Street are often used by small towns or developments to treat sewage on site. The Iowa Department of Natural Resources told the city that for the aging lagoon system to meet state and federal wastewater discharge requirements, the city would need to either make substantial improvements or decommission the lagoons and connect that cluster of businesses to the rest of the city's system. You have to meet the standards at some point, Merritt said, and the question is whether you do it on site or you do it as part of our overarching collection system, which ends at our treatment facility. We feel it's better if we don't have separate systems set up throughout the city. Building the new sewer line also has a secondary benefit of adding sewer infrastructure to land that didn't previously have any sewer connection. Merritt said, the city council is considering another industrial park in western Davenport near I-280 as shovel-ready parcels dwindle at the Eastern Iowa Industrial Center in northern Davenport, where Amazon recently opened its massive robotics fulfillment center. One of the first things people look for when they look for development is, does the land have the necessary public infrastructure out there to serve that development? Merritt said. Because if you don't, it takes time to get that installed. For instance, this project will take about 2 years. In the year 2006, Damon Kingsley II and Paula Kingsley bought an 1850s-era home off Hickory Grove Road with 6 acres of land, or 6 acres of lawn, farmland, and towering oak trees that shaded the property. A portion of the property's yard is along the new pipe's path. The Kingleys don't live there full-time anymore. A separate dispute and frequent trespassers became too much for the family, and they moved to a place in Mount Joy, but kept the Davenport homestead and returned frequently to keep the lawn clipped, hold bonfires, and otherwise keep up the property. Over the summer, vandals smashed the windows and tore off siding from the home's tower, the Kingsleys said. They opted to board up the windows temporarily to make its renovation their retirement project. But now, several of those towering 100-plus-year-old oaks with wide, shady canopies that the Kingsleys have come to associate with home have been toppled to make way for the sewer. The Kingsleys say city officials never met or negotiated with them for their land before initiating condemnation proceedings for the yard and trees. The city, for its part, disputes that and says it sent an offer letter in January 2023 for $15,000 for the land. The Kingsleys say they did not receive an offer letter. The Kingsleys believe the sewer line could have routed through a nearby portion of the property and could have avoided cutting down the century-old oaks if the city had approached them first. An arborist hired by the Kingsleys estimated 17 bur oak, 2 honey locust, and 1 redbud trees on their property to be worth between about $227,000 and $245,000. The arborist, Scott Carlson, recommended the sewer not be installed in a location that would destroy several of Iowa's official state trees, bur oaks. A compensation board made up of Scott County residents met September the 28th and assessed city should pay $30,000 to the Kingsleys for the property. The city wrote a check to that amount, but the Kingsleys said they never picked it up. The Kingsleys have appealed the compensation board's decision in court. Patty?
Thank you. 3 arrested for shooting that damaged vehicle. Written by Anthony Watt. 3 men faced charges for a Sunday shooting in Davenport in which an occupied vehicle was struck multiple times. Scott County authorities have charged Nyonte Thompson Ford, 22, Morio D. Rogers, 24, and Jamal Gilliam, 23, with intimidation with a dangerous weapon, court records state. Thompson Ford of Rock Island has also been charged with first-degree criminal mischief and dominion and or control of a firearm or offensive weapon by a felon, records state. The shooting happened just before 4 a.m. in the 400 block of East Locust Street, according to court records. Police officers were in a parking lot dealing with a disturbance involving as many as 50 people when they heard 15 to 20 shots nearby in the area of LeClaire and Locust Streets. The officers then saw a silver 2012 Chrysler 200 speeding away west on Locust Street. Court records state. When they attempted to stop it, the driver did not comply with their command. The police department gave the officers permission to pursue the Chrysler, and they did so. During the pursuit, officers saw the passenger in the right rear seat throw a firearm out the window. According to court records, police stopped the Chrysler on River Drive underneath the Interstate 74 bridge in Moline. As many as 5 people attempted to run away from the vehicle, but police captured 3 of them, including the person who was sitting in the right rear seat. Authorities identified that passenger as Thompson Ford and the other 2 who were arrested as Gilliam of Davenport and Rogers of Rock Island. Investigators recovered a 9mm pistol from the area where police saw the gun thrown from the car, according to court records. They also recovered 5 spent 9mm shell casings and 1 live 9mm round from the rear passenger floor of the Chrysler. They also recovered a bullet fragment from the Chrysler, records state. At the scene of the shooting, officers found more 9mm shell casings and 5.7mm shell casings, records state. They also found the vehicle targeted in the attack. It had been struck several times, with the damage estimated around $10,000. When the shooting occurred, there were 2 occupants inside record state. By firing into the vehicle, Thompson Ford placed those two in immediate fear of serious injury, authorities contend in court records. Thompson Ford has a 2023 felony conviction in Rock Island County. Gilliam and Rogers were knowingly and willingly in the Chrysler when the gun was fired into the other vehicle. Thompson Ford was free on a $50,000 bond as of Wednesday, according to the Scott County Jail. Rogers and Gilliam remained in custody, each held on $25,000. All three have a court appearance scheduled for April 19th, records state. And then another article from that same page. Man charged with murder denied release, written for us by Lisa Hamas. Cambridge, the alleged March 24 shooting of a Kewanee man happened after he followed the accused's vehicle, in his own vehicle, and allegedly punched him. Judge Colby Hathaway found probable cause to believe Jose Valentin, 43, of Galva, committed a felony during a hearing Monday in Henry County Circuit Court. Valentin is charged with two counts of first-degree murder in the incident. Kewanee Police Detective Trey Kazubowski testified officers were called to the 100 block of Houle Avenue a little after 7:30 p.m. March 24th. They found a gunshot victim lying in the street covered in blood with a gunshot wound to his neck, identified as Jimmy Hollins II. According to Kazubowski, witnesses advised they saw a silver Yukon SUV followed by Hollins in a GMC Yukon or Chevy Tahoe. They said the silver SUV was driven by some guy named Jose Lefo. However, through investigation, it was determined Lito was Jose Valentin. The registration on the vehicle came back to Stacy Rivero, Valentin's wife. Police gathered a phone message saying Valentin was riding dirty, meaning he had anything from narcotics to a weapon, according to Kazubowski's testimony. A shell casing was recovered from the scene, and a weapon was recovered from a witness. The witness gave a statement that Valentin came to the house, set the weapon on a table, and said, "I cannot ride dirty back to Chicago." And there was a brief conversation, and Valentin left. The witness also indicated in his statement that an altercation had occurred, and Hollins punched Valentin. Then Valentin displayed a firearm and fired it. Kazubowski said the firearm had been sent to the lab, but to date there was no report back as to whether it was the same gun from which the fatal shot was fired. In response to defense attorney John Runt's cross-examination, Kazubowski said there was no witness in the shooting itself. Judge Hathaway granted the state's motion to deny Valentin pre-trial release, and he will remain in custody. In making the ruling, the judge noted Valentin's flight after the incident and that he deleted his social media accounts. Hathaway said he didn't believe Valentin would comply with conditions attached to any release, and there was a high likelihood he would engage in flight to avoid prosecution. A pre-trial hearing was set for May 16th.
Thank you, Patty. Judge tosses plea agreement. It's written by Sarah Watson of the Quad City Times. A Scott County judge rejected a plea agreement reached with the former executive director of the Freight House Farmers Market, Lorraine Beeman, who is accused of stealing the nonprofit's funds. Beeman pleaded guilty to theft in the second degree, a Class D felony, and her and the state's attorneys asked Judge Tom Riddle for a sentence of deferred judgment and supervised probation. In documents filed with the court, Beeman wrote that she used Freight House debit cards for personal expenses on Amazon, purchases totaling about $1,500, which was not authorized by the Freight House board. The judge cited that the Amazon purchases indicated a repeated offense, not a one-time incident that warranted a deferred judgment, which would allow the charges to be dropped after meeting certain conditions during a probation period. Beeman's attorney, Andrea Yeager, withdrew Beeman's guilty plea. A pretrial hearing is set for April 19th. Yeager told the judge Beeman had already paid the Freight House nonprofit more than $10,000 to date, which Yeager said demonstrated Beeman's genuine remorse and makes the Freight House whole above and beyond the $1,500 in losses admitted to in the plea agreement. Yeager also pointed to Beeman's lack of criminal history or prior arrests and cited her history of gainful employment and being active in the community as signs the chance of her recidivism would, in her view, be zero. A former board member, Christine Van Vooren, painted a different picture in an impact statement before the court Wednesday. She told the judge Beeman's betrayal left an indelible mark on the organization and alleged Beeman had not shown remorse. Beeman once was an integral part of Freight House Farmers Market operations, Van Vooren said, but Beeman had shaken their trust and disrupted camaraderie among market vendors. Van Vooren said the misappropriated funds could have advanced their organization, but were instead used for personal purchases, including paying for an attorney's fees to start a personal nonprofit. Van Vooren alleged Beeman has tried to remain involved or intimidate the current Freight House Farmers Market organization. Van Vooren said Beeman remained in touch with vendors to try to rally sympathy, left a phone message on the current executive director's phone, offered assistance to vendors, wore Freight House merchandise to a recent event, and tried to pressure the nonprofit's leaders to involve her despite the board of directors expressing they did not want her involved. Lori continues to haunt our organization, Van Vooren said. She added that the emotional toll of Beeman's actions cannot be overstated. The judge, Riedel, sustained an objection from Yeager to Van Vooren's statement and said he would only look at the facts in considering the plea agreement. Riedel rejected the plea agreement, saying deferred judgment is typically reserved for isolated incidents, and he was concerned by Beeman's admission to repeated purchases on Amazon using the nonprofit's debit cards. Yeager withdrew Beeman's guilty plea, and the judge ordered a pretrial conference to be scheduled. Yeager declined to comment after the hearing. Patty?
Thank you. I think that it must be time for the obituaries. And there are three. Excuse me. Reverend Gary Dalmasso, October 4, 1947 to April 9th. Funeral services celebrating the life of the Reverend Gary Dalmasso, will be held at 10 a.m. Friday, April 12th at Beulah Presbyterian Church, 921 148th Avenue in Orion. Visitation will be at 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, April 11th at Halligan McCabe DeVries Funeral Home in Davenport. In lieu of flowers, the family requests memorials be made to the family for a scholarship fund they are establishing in Gary and Judith's names. Gary Dalmasso passed away on April 9th. His family was at his side as he took his last breath. Over the last several years, Gary's children and grandchildren were there to support and comfort him after he lost the love of his life, Judith, in 2022. They cherished their time with him as they found joy in the ordinary and family time together. Gary built a legacy of love that will last for generations to come. Born on October 4th, 1942, Gary was raised by loving parents and grandparents and had wonderful memories of his childhood in Norris, Illinois. He felt a calling to the priesthood during his college years and attended the General Theology Seminary in New York City and was ordained at an Episcopal priest in 1967. His first assignment was to establish a new church, which would later become St. Mark's Episcopal Church. As he rode into Silvis, Illinois, with his 1965 Mustang, he made quite an impression to his new parishioners, who had never met a priest quite like him before. In 1968, Gary's life was altered once again as he married Judith Wilson. They built a happy life together and remained best friends until her passing in 2022. In 1985, together, they co-founded Renewal in Christ Ministries, abbreviation RICM, and subsequently traveled the world spreading the word of God. They held over 300 renewal weekends all over the United States and as far away as the Netherlands. We give glory to God for Gary's life and for all the lives he touched. While we are sad that he is no longer with us, we rejoice that he is at peace and finally reunited with his beloved Judith. Gary is preceded in death by his loving wife, Judith, parents Joseph and Maxine Dalmasso, his brother Denny Dalmasso, and his granddaughter Abigail Davila. Survivors include 4 children, 12 grandchildren, and 3 great-grandchildren, his brother and sister-in-law, Terry and Mary Dalmasso, and his sister-in-law, Dorothy Ann Gift. He is also survived by a close family friend that he loved as a brother, Olin M. Morrow. Online tribute may be expressed at hmdfuneralhome.com. And then, from Davenport, Joseph E. Kastner, December 5th, 1931 to April 7th. Joseph E. Kastner, age 92, of Davenport, passed away Sunday evening, April 7th. A memorial mass will be held at 1 p.m. Saturday, April 13th, at Our Lady of Victory Catholic Church, Davenport. The family will greet friends from 12 noon until the time of service. Luncheon will be provided after the service. Burial will be at a later date in Violet Hill Cemetery in Perry. Joe was born December 5th, 1931, on the family farm southwest of Vale. Iowa, the youngest of Austrian immigrants Frank and Emily Biderman Kastner. He attended Panora High School, where he was class president and captain of the football team. After graduation, Joe continued working on the family farm until enlisting in the U.S. Air Force during the Korean War and was stationed in Greenland with friend David Fish. During their service, David and Joe met twin sisters Joanne and Janice Allison at Offutt Air Force Base. After completing his military service, Joe and Jan married in 1956 and moved to Des Moines, where he attended Iowa State University and obtained his degree in architectural engineering. After graduation, the family moved to Davenport in 1961, where Joe and Jan designed and built a new home on evenings and weekends with 2 toddlers in tow. Joe was employed by King Scott and Associates designing schools and commercial projects, for which he received several architectural design awards. When King Scott and Associates closed their Davenport office in 1975, he went to work for Priester Construction as an architect and project manager, where he remained working into his mid-70s. Joe had the ability to repair or fix just about anything. He restored and enjoyed working on a 1944 pickup, a 1966 Mustang convertible, and his pristine 1999 Mustang GT convertible. He enjoyed following auto racing, including attending NASCAR racing events with his boys, and at age 82, drove hot laps in a cup car at the Chicago Speedway. He was an avid sports fan, especially anything related to the Iowa State Cyclones. Joe is a founding member and chairman of the building committee for Our Lady of Victory Catholic Church. His faith, family, and friends were at the heart of everything he did. He was a constant inspiration to us all. Survivors included daughter Julie Kastner, Michael Kastner, and Paul Kastner, and three grandchildren, four. Joe was preceded in death by his wife Janice and siblings. Online condolences may be made to the family by visiting his obituary at hmdfuneralhome.com. And then I have a few pendings. Fred A. Brown Moline died Wednesday, April 10th in Silvis, Illinois. Arrangements at Van Ho Funeral Home, East Moline. James L. Finley, 83, Arcadia, Florida, formerly of Hampton, Illinois, passed away Tuesday, April 9th at Arcadia Hospice House in Arcadia, Florida. Arrangements are pending at Whelan Presley Funeral Home and Crematory, Milan. Royce Glendale Hamrick, 80, Moline, passed away Saturday, April 6th at his residence. Cremation will be directed by Mississippi Valley Cremation and direct burial in Moline. Joseph E. Strunk, 57, Orion, Illinois, passed away Friday, April 5th at his residence. Cremation will be directed by Mississippi Valley Cremation and direct burial in Moline.
Thank you, Patty. Now we'll move on to the opinion page, and we've got another view from Bloomberg News entitled, "Healthcare is Still Too Costly for Americans. Public option should be revived as states experiment with new ways to ease expense." America's approach to healthcare is an outlier among the world's rich countries, and not in a good way. Extraordinarily complex and hideously expensive, it still manages to leave some 26 million people without coverage. The Affordable Care Act of 2010 made notable progress but failed to solve the pressing problems of high costs and less than universal access. The ACA fell short partly because legislators dropped the so-called public option. This idea should be revived. The dysfunction in Washington makes such innovation difficult at the federal level, but states have been trying variants. These experiments are worth watching. The need for more reform is clear. The U.S. spends about 17% of gross domestic product on healthcare, far more than comparable countries, yet on many metrics, including life expectancy, U.S. outcomes are worse. The system's enormous cost is partly hidden because most Americans are insured through their employers. The premiums suppress wages, so the true hit to families' finances is disguised. Even covered employees can be on the hook for additional charges, enough in some cases to pay for a small car. Workers fear that losing their jobs will mean they lose their insurance. More than half of the 20 million who've signed up for Obamacare in 2024 complain of high monthly costs and out-of-pocket spending. And despite the ACA, roughly 10% of Americans still have no coverage at all. When Obamacare was taking shape, some lawmakers envisioned a public option, a government-run plan that would compete alongside private insurance. Like Medicare, it would save money by negotiating prices and cutting costs. Voters liked the idea, but it met stiff industry opposition and was ultimately scrapped. During his presidential campaign a decade later, Joe Biden supported a public option, but his administration has focused on other ways to make health care more affordable. Yet the public option wasn't quite dead. As a result of the ACA, states have been able to try innovative strategies to lower costs and broaden coverage. Three have used it to advance programs they're calling public options, and a handful of others have plans underway. Colorado's scheme is especially popular, thanks to generous benefits, including free primary and mental health care, and lower premiums than many marketplace plans. State law requires insurers to meet annual premium reduction targets, and the insurers negotiate hard with hospitals to cut costs. If they miss the targets, insurers and providers alike can be summoned to public hearings. The existing system is undeniably failing. In poll after poll, Americans say rising health care costs are a top concern. States should keep trying new approaches to see what works. And Washington should put the Medicare-based public option back on the agenda. Again, that was from Bloomberg News.
I will read one more editorial, then we'll go on to the sports. The Trump tax cuts were neither panacea nor ripoff. Written for us by Carl W. Smith. Back in 2017, the debate around President Donald Trump's tax cuts was a case study in how quickly a discussion around legitimate policy can descend into partisan nonsense. On one side, Republicans spouted unfounded claims that the tax cuts would pay for themselves. On the other, Democrats spouted equally unfounded claims that only big business and the wealthy would benefit. As usual, the truth landed somewhere in the middle. No, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017 didn't pay for itself, but at this moment, reversing the marquee part of the legislation, lower tax rates for companies, to help narrow the bulging budget deficit is the last thing we should do. And while the cuts yielded benefits to Americans up and down the income scale, the benefits could best be described as modest. Understanding what the legislation did and didn't do is relevant now because it expires in 2025, and whoever wins this year's presidential election will have to decide whether to extend it. What's not in dispute is that the act represented the most sweeping overhaul of the tax system since the Reagan administration. For businesses, it's aimed to spur capital spending by slashing the corporate tax from 35% to 21%. For individuals, it lowered rates across the board and simplified the code by limiting itemized deductions, increasing the standard deduction taken by those who don't itemize, and expanding access to the child tax credit. The problem now is that largely because of fiscal spending to support the economy through the pandemic, the federal budget deficit has expanded to 6.44% of gross domestic product from 4.67% at the end of 2019, which at the time was the biggest shortfall since 2013. Also, the cost of servicing the deficit by borrowing has soared along with benchmark interest rates the past 2 years. For this reason alone, it's possible some, but not all, of the cuts will be reversed. But which ones? Whatever is decided, the corporate cuts are probably the last thing we want to repeal. Despite the insistence of Republicans who point to the rise in federal revenue following 2017, we can't shrink the deficit by further reducing taxes. In 2022, federal revenue came in at $4.9 trillion, far higher than the $4.2 trillion predicted by the bipartisan Congressional Budget Office before the tax cuts. Two factors are responsible for the outperformance. One, capital gains tax revenue jumped following the stock market's big rally in 2020 and 2021. Two, a worker shortage during the pandemic caused wages to rise by almost 5% in 2021. Higher wages not only led to higher incomes, but also pushed many Americans into higher tax brackets, thereby increasing revenue. Democrats have described the tax cuts as benefiting only the wealthy. This is also a gross distortion of the facts. Between 2017 and 2019, taxpayers at both the bottom and top of the income scale saw their average tax rate decline by a little less than 1%. Those in between saw more significant reductions, with the upper middle class, defined by as those making $200,000 to $500,000 a year, seeing their tax rates decline by 2.5%. This reflects that many are small business owners who, along with big corporations, received additional tax cuts designed to encourage economic growth. In theory, cutting taxes on businesses encourages them to expand production because it increases their after-tax profit margins. Hence, companies are more willing to hire workers and invest in technology or equipment to boost sales, spurring economic growth. In practice, many Democrats and even some Republicans were concerned that businesses would use those higher profits to fund stock buybacks or higher dividend payouts to investors. Indeed, buybacks did increase sharply after 2017. For example, Apple Inc. doubled stock buybacks as its investment in the U.S. declined. That was a bad look, but it doesn't necessarily mean tax cuts didn't work. If there had been none, Apple might have decided to decrease investment even more to fund stock buybacks. The Trump tax cuts were neither an economic panacea nor a ripoff. They produced a modest but meaningful increase in income for working Americans, both by reducing their tax burdens and increasing their wages. Lawmakers should keep this in the front of their minds as they debate how much, if any, of those tax cuts to keep. And Mr. Smith is a Bloomberg columnist and assistant professor of economics at the University of North Carolina.
Thank you, Patty. Now, here's a reminder that you are listening to the Quad City Times on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. We'll move on to sports, and here's what's on television today. In college baseball, at 6 p.m. on the ACC Network, you can see Miami at Florida State. Also at 6 p.m. on the SEC Network, you can see Missouri at Georgia. And at 6:30 p.m. on ESPNU, it's Kentucky at Auburn. College hockey, the Frozen Four is going on. At 4 p.m. on ESPN2, it's Denver versus Boston. And at 7 p.m. on ESPN2, it's Michigan versus Boston. Golf, the Masters, starts today. It's on ESPN starting at 2 p.m. In Major League Baseball, at noon on the Major League Baseball Network, it's the New York Mets at Atlanta. And also on the Major League Baseball Network at 6 p.m., it's Baltimore at Boston. In the NBA, we've got Chicago at Washington, 6 p.m. on the NBC Sports Channel, 6:30 p.m. New York at Boston on TNT, and 9 p.m. New Orleans at Sacramento on TNT. And now I'll read this one sports article. Clark bids farewell. Legend says this place will always be home to me. It's written by John Bonenkamp of the Associated Press. Dateline is Iowa City. Caitlin Clark got a final chance to say goodbye to Iowa fans on Wednesday, and of course, there was a big crowd waiting. Clark, who became major college basketball's all-time leading scorer this season on the way to being the consensus National Player of the Year, was honored along with her teammates in a celebration at Iowa's home arena commemorating the Hawkeyes' second consecutive national runner-up finish in the NCAA tournament. "I would say you've all inspired me as much as I inspired you," Clark said to the approximately 8,000 fans at Iowa's Carver Hawkeye Arena. "And you allowed me to live out my dream every single day, and for that, I'm very thankful. It's been very special, and this place will always be home to me." Clark, expected to be the number one overall pick by the Indiana Fever in Monday's WNBA draft, finished her career with 3,951 points and 1,144 assists, an All-American in every season in a career that started playing in front of sparse crowds during her freshman year when attendance was limited because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Clark received a standing ovation when Iowa Athletics Director Beth Goetz announced that Clark's jersey number 22 will be retired, the third number to be retired in program history. I think they like you, Goetz said to Clark after the announcement. It's super incredible, something I'm very thankful for, Clark said. There's been a lot of good 22s who have come before me and played for this program, whether it was Kathleen Doyle or Sam Logic. That number holds a lot of weight far beyond me. I'm really grateful, and it will be a special day when it happens. Iowa coach Lisa Bluder called the Hawkeyes' back-to-back runs to the national championship game special. This year's was also special because nobody thought we could do it, she said. Nobody thought we could repeat what we did last year, except these women up here. The attendance for the event wasn't surprising, given the Hawkeyes' ability to draw big crowds this season. The Hawkeyes sold out every home game, drawing 238,620 fans during the regular season, and that total doesn't include the 55,646 fans who showed up for the crossover at Kinnick outdoor exhibition game in October at Iowa's Kinnick Stadium that set the women's basketball single-game attendance record. Iowa also sold out its two NCAA tournament games. The weekend attendance of 28,764 was the most of any first weekend site in the women's tournament. Please come back next year, Bluder said. Please fill Carver Hawkeye Arena next year. Fans were lined up outside of the arena more than 2 hours before the event started, racing to find seats when the doors opened. Angie Lee of Atlantic, Iowa, brought her 10-year-old daughter, Lana, who was celebrating her birthday, to the event. Clark circled the arena floor to sign autographs after the event, as she has after games throughout her career. She spoke during the event how she and her two brothers idolized athletes growing up. I wanted to be like them, she said. Those were the people who allowed me to dream and be in moments like this. Lee knew what the Hawkeyes' recent success meant to her daughter, whose sign also said about Clark, I want to be just like you. It's a dream come true, and it's made her dream bigger, Lee said.
I'll read some sports shorts. Edie wins men's wooden award. This is college basketball. Los Angeles. Jack Edie of Purdue became the second two-time John R. Wooden Award winner as the nation's top men's college basketball player. Edie joins Virginia's Ralph Sampson, who won in 1982 and 83. Edie led the nation in scoring and set school records for career points and rebounds. He led the Boilermakers to the national championship game, where they lost to UC Cong. Vandeveer ends coaching career. Stanford, California. Stanford Tara Vandeveer is retiring at age 70, and with 1,216 career victories in stops at Idaho, Ohio State, and Stanford, 45 years in all. She will stay involved as her top assistant coach and former player. Kate Pay is poised to take over the program. We've heard this one before. Arkansas officially hires Calipari in Fayetteville. Arkansas hired John Calipari as men's basketball coach a day after the Hall of Fame coach stepped down from the Kentucky program he led to the 2012 NCAA championship. The 65-year-old Calipari signed a 5-year contract with a base annual salary of $7 million through April 2029. The deal includes a variety of bonuses and incentive bonuses. Green Bay women's coach retires. Green Bay's Kevin Borseth is retiring from college basketball after winning 821 games and earning 14 NCAA tournament berths during a 37-year head coaching career. Borseth owned an 821-316 overall record to rank 16th among all divisions, a Division I women's basketball coaches in total wins. Green Bay went 27-7 this season and made its first NCAA tournament appearance since 2018. And, college football. Washington player charged with two rapes. Seattle. Court documents show a University of Washington football player has been arrested and charged with raping two women in Seattle, King TV reports. Seattle police officers arrested 18-year-old Tylan Tybo Rogers on Friday and booked him into King County Jail. He was charged Tuesday with second-degree rape and third-degree rape. The university athletic department said in a statement that Rogers had been suspended from all team activities until further notice. And Allen reaches deal with Jaguars in Jacksonville. A person familiar with the negotiations says standout pass rusher Josh Allen has signed a 5-year contract that maxes out at $150 million and includes up to $88 million guaranteed. Allen set a single-season franchise record with 17.5 sacks in the final year of his rookie contract and 10 shy of the team's career mark of 55, held by Tony Brackett.
City Times for today to Thursday, April 11th. I'm Scott Splavik, and my partner at the microphone has been Patty Daniels. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.